All right, y'all, welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I hate stupid people. Fucking idiots. Hey, this is Scott Horton Show. Sorry I missed the past couple of days, man. I had a thing came up, and then another thing came up, and then... So now, what do you know, I had to miss a couple of shows. But anyway, I got a show for you today. Andrew Coburn's going to be back on the show. He's got a great piece called Undelivered Goods in Harper's here about Ukraine. Just a small part of the tale of American intervention in Ukraine over the last few years. I'm told here by Andrew Coburn. I think you'll find it very interesting. And then Brad Smith is going to be here, and he's a fan of the show who was in the Panama War. Remember that? 1989? George Bush Sr. didn't consult the Congress, didn't consult the baby blue UN or NATO or the Organization of American States or any other supposed collective security arrangement. He just decided, you know what? Let's have a war in Panama and invade Panama. Him and Dick Cheney and Colin Powell and the whole Desert Storm crew. That was their trial run for the first Iraq war down there in Panama. And you know, there's the Panama Deception is a great documentary if you've never seen it. It's narrated by Elizabeth Montgomery from Bewitched. Did you know that? And I'd suggest that you look at that. And then... Man, you know, I don't think I have ever written, I don't think I've ever read a good book about that war. I think the only book that I ever read about the Panama War was Bob Woodward, The Commanders, about that war in Gulf War I, but it was Bob Woodward, so he might as well still be naval intelligence writing the crap he writes. Maybe he is, but anyway. So, Brad Smith, he was there. And so he's going to tell us about it, that's all. Nice little bit of history of the American Empire for you there. Alright. Alright, so here's a bit of housekeeping stuff. The guy that we hired to move all the 4,000 almost interviews to YouTube, was unable to get it done. So, it's not that your money has been destroyed or anything like that. It's just that it's still sitting there. The guy didn't get any money. I don't think he got paid anything for starting. I'm not sure what the problem was. He seemed like a nice guy. I ain't saying nothing bad about him, but just didn't work out. However, I got a good lead on somebody else who is believed will be able to handle this task for us. The project, again, I'm referring, in case you don't know what the hell I'm talking about, I did a Kickstarter a few months ago, and everybody was as generous as hell. I met the goal of raising $500 in just a few hours, and in 24 hours had almost doubled it, I think, or wasn't it that? Something like that? Very close to that. So it was one of those, holy crap, you guys really like me. Thanks a lot, man. I really appreciate it. And then you're all sitting there wondering, okay, I gave you my money. Where's the YouTubes, dude? Like in the deal. Did you spend that money on new skateboard wheels, Scott Horton, or what? And the answer is, no, I didn't. I swear. What happened was we hired a guy to do it, and we waited and waited and waited and waited and then quit waiting. But I swear I'm going to get on today. I'm going to get on hiring the new guy. And the guy that I know, who knows the guy, is really sure that it's going to work out good. And the guy that I know, who knows the guy, is the guy that runs the server now. So, I'm thinking it's going to be a good deal there. We're going to get it done. And if not, if you know what, if the next two or three people fail at this and we can't get it done, I guess I'll give you all your money back and, you know, write shame on my forehead real big in blue letters for a few days or something. I don't know. I would be very embarrassed. Wouldn't that be funny? That probably would be pretty funny. But no, it's going to get done. I know a guy now who knows a guy who's going to be able to do it. So, and then I think, you know, hopefully that'll be a cool thing when all the interviews are on YouTube. I mean, it shouldn't be that big of a game changing anything or anything like that, but you know, another way for people to find the show. And I guess a lot of people, they just would rather hear their audio on a YouTube anyway. It's easier to embed or whatever. But all right, so cool. We're working on it, just so you know. All right, now here's the other thing. Top story of the day. Good news. Mikulski. Senator. Somebody. Barbara. Senator Barbara A. Mikulski announced today that she is supporting the Iran deal. She is a senator from Maryland. And that means that if they pass their, if the Republican House and Senate pass their anti-Iran deal resolution and Obama vetoes it, they will be unable to override that veto. That's it. It's a done deal. The Iran deal is a done deal today. Yay! Now, I'm not really supporting a government program here or the government actually doing anything other than them stopping doing things. And that's what they're doing. I mean, I guess the IAEA is a government program, but not really a U.S. government one. And yes, these things can be tripwires to war and that kind of thing, but that's not what this is. This isn't just some fake excuse to pretend we tried, but now we have no resort. That was what a lot of hawks wanted, but now they've been really short-circuited here, I think. Now the race is on to see, hey, since it's a done deal, maybe the rest of the Democrats can get on board here and go ahead and get the 60 votes they need to do a filibuster and prevent the Republicans from even passing the Senate resolution. That would be nice. A real repudiation of Israeli intervention in American domestic political affairs. Pushed it too far. Now we're pissed off. See if we can even get it where they can't even send the resolution to the president to veto in the first place. That would be nice. But anyway, I'll take it. So thank you, Senator Mikulski. Everybody call Senator Mikulski and say, thank you. And all America's doing here really is we're lifting a bunch of sanctions on them, giving them their money back, their assets frozen by the U.S. and allied governments. It's not welfare from us. It's their money that is being released back to them. And we're legalizing international trade with Iran again. Before that, it was an economic war against their civilian population, see? And so now America's stopping that. And people say, better deal, better deal. We already had a deal. We've had a nuclear deal with Iran since the 1960s. When their government and our government, in fact, their government belonged to our government back then, signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And even after the Revolution of 79, they never were in violation of it. They've never enriched weapons-grade uranium. They never had a nuclear weapons program. Read Manufactured Crisis by Gareth Porter. All they had was a civilian safeguarded, IAEA safeguarded, unalienable right type, as referred to in the NPT, type civilian nuclear program. This entire thing was a crisis manufactured in Tel Aviv, and as Gareth puts it in his book, and in D.C., and so now they put it to bed. That's it. So I guess that doesn't really mean that all options are no longer on the table. They still reserve the right to do a first strike. The U.S. government reserves the right to do a first strike to start a war against any country in the world right now. That's our official national security strategy. You know that. But at least they've really turned down the tension by a hell of a lot. Implementation day is January the 1st, I believe. Let's look forward to that. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. This is my show, the Scott Horton Show. All right, Iran. Ha ha, F you, Israel. Seriously, go jump in a lake. You lost. Lost. I like that. Isn't it nice when the Israeli fifth column of foreign government loyal American traitors lose. And no, I don't mean Jews. In fact, American Jews, by a wide margin, support the Iran deal, of course. It's not that. So there you go. Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the head of the DNC, scotched a resolution at the Democratic National Committee meeting to support the deal. Can you believe that? The president's signature accomplishment besides making health care worse. And she blocked it. People were pissed. This is going to be a big fight in the Democratic Party. Remember in, I think it was in 12, right? When had the voice votes at the Democratic convention and they had a resolution on Palestine and the pro-Palestine people clearly won. But then the chair, who I think was the mayor of LA or something at the time, just lied basically. Looked to his left for instructions and went ahead and said that the thing failed, even though it clearly did not fail. So we're going to see more of that. The Republicans, they all put Israel first. All of them. But in the Democratic Party, at least, there will be a little bit of a fight about it. I thought this was funny. Well, I think lots of things that Trump says are funny. Donald Trump says that the nuclear deal basically amounts to a treaty whereby if Israel attacks Iran, America will have to defend Iran from Israel. We'll have to join in the war on Iran's side. Oh, yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure I heard somewhere that that's probably in there somewhere, right? Isn't that what it is? We're bringing Iran into NATO, is that it? No, of course. They're just taking a couple of words and deliberately twisting them out of context. Now, Trump is like fifth guy in line on the telephone game here. So he's getting the, you know, completely run down version of this BS. He doesn't even have the words to pretend to quote here. That he says, we have to come to their defense. No. What it says is the IAEA and the Americans who will be cooperating with, will be helping them actually reconfigure their nuclear reactor at Iraq, for example, and we'll be part of this, that they're all obligated to help keep Iran's nuclear secrets and protect them from infiltration. There's nothing specifically about Israel in there. Of course, whenever Israel was sabotaging the Iranians, the Americans are in on all that, assassinating scientists and putting all the viruses in there in the Natanz centrifuges and all that stuff. Those were joint American and Israeli projects, really. Well, I don't know about the assassinations, but I'm pretty sure that they at least had, you know, go ahead and use the MEK to kill these guys. All they were talking about is this is all highly classified stuff. And of course, yes, we promise to keep confidentiality and help you secure your facilities, etc. There's nothing in there about we'll go to war for you if the Israelis decide they hate this deal so much they launch a war. We all know America would do whatever the Israelis wanted them to do in that situation. But anyway, He says this to Don Lemon. And Don Lemon, he's like, correct me if I'm wrong. And Lemon's like, and just asks him something else. All right. Hey, you're a news guy. Am I right about that? And Don Lemon's like, I don't know. Yeah, no, you don't. Oh, Dick Cheney and Liz Cheney had an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. I forgot to get around to reading it yet. I'm sure it's pretty bad. You'll like it. It'll be great. Oh, and then I like this too. When Netanyahu was in Italy, he said, we don't have any problem with Iran having a civilian nuclear program. We're only upset over their military, over the military implications. Yeah, in other words, the fuel cycle. Oh, yeah. They can have a nuclear program. They should just have to import all of their uranium. Well, first of all, that's brand new. But secondly, how disingenuous is that? At Israeli behest, America and Europe have done everything they can to prevent Iran from importing uranium from anywhere else. The rule generated in Tel Aviv has been no nuclear program at all for you. The rule has been let's all just pretend that the civilian nuclear program is a nuclear weapons program. This whole time. Oh, now he says, I don't have a problem with them having nuclear reactors. They should just have to buy the fuel from somewhere else. Oh, too bad, because of you, they had the last decade to master the fuel cycle. Tough titty for you, Israel. Oh, and then there's this great piece. I wanted to get Ali Gharib on to talk about this, but I didn't get a chance to. He's hard to get a hold of, man. But he wrote this thing at Loblog. Some dubious characters and connections among ex-military foes of Iran deal. And it's about how these guys are, remember I mentioned to you last week, they're Iran-Contra guys. They're the guys that helped sell weapons to the Ayatollah for Ronald Reagan in the 1980s in order they can make a bunch of extra money so they could prop up death squads down in Nicaragua and El Salvador, chopping little babies into pieces with machetes. And these are the guys, Richard Secord and John Poindexter, Admiral John Poindexter, these are the guys who sold weapons to Iran are coming out against this. Well, and guess who's backing them all? The same guys who put you into war in Iraq in 2003. The men from JINSA, the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs. It's not just another think tank. What they do is they organize meetings and cooperation and joint programs and vacations and whatever mingling they possibly can between American generals and admirals and the Israelis to integrate our militaries with them as much as they possibly can. Now, we can't have an official treaty of alliance with Israel because they don't have defined borders, because they're not done stealing all their neighbors' land yet, they swear. And so, according to American law, we can't have a treaty with a country that doesn't have defined borders. So we just have this de facto kind of treaty alliance where people like Rand Paul make statements that say any attack on Israel will be treated as an attack on the United States, even though that's not the law at all. But I guess if it was him, he wouldn't even bother going to the Congress to ask. Anyway, that's the corrupt pro-Israel interests, compromised interests who came out against the Iran deal. Great expose of them. Even if it's sure to pass the Senate now, all the, you know, carping about it isn't over yet. So it's good to arm up on facts like these. Ali Gharib and Grace Kaysen at Loblog. Some dubious characters and connections among ex-military foes of the Iran deal. Oh, and by the way, the Iranians are erasing all the Death to America graffiti all across Tehran. Did you know that? Did you see that?
I love Bitcoin, but there's just something incredibly satisfying about having real, fine silver in your pocket. That's why commodity discs are so neat. They're 1 ounce rounds of fine silver with a QR code on the back. Just grab your smartphone's QR reader, scan the coin, and you'll instantly get the silver spot price in Federal Reserve notes and Bitcoin. And if you donate $100 to the Scott Horton Show, he'll send you one. Learn more at facebook.com/commoditydiscs. Commoditydiscs.com.
Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our statist enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton on the line. I got Andrew Coburn. I love me some Coburns, man. I used to love Alex. He's gone now, but Patrick, of course, is the greatest war reporter in the world. And his brother Andrew does incredible work on the national security state here in the United States and how it works and operates at those levels. Welcome back to the show, Andrew. How are you, sir?
Hey, Scott. Good to be with you.
Very happy to have you back here on the show. Undelivered goods. How $1.8 billion in aid to Ukraine was funneled to the outposts of the international finance galaxy. What fun! tell us, first of all, you do a good job in the intro to the article here, giving us kind of the rundown, the catch-up. Pretend nobody in the audience ever heard of American intervention in Ukraine. So let us know, you know, I don't know. As you do here, kind of late 2013 through now, what's the crisis and the context, so then we can get to where all the money went?
Okay, fine. Ukraine, the country of Ukraine, is unfortunately kind of an economic basket case. Partly, on even maybe mostly, because all of the place is really controlled by these so-called oligarchs who basically control the economy of, you know, help themselves to big chunks of what was the Soviet economy there. So, that being the case, well, let me say, in 2013, it was decided that we should, that the IMF should give a huge amount of money to, Ukraine because to save it going under, to save the currency and all those good things. So, they announced that they were going to send $17 billion altogether, and they were sending $4 billion immediately. Now, the most important destination for this money was the country's banks, which were all going belly up, and most specifically, the largest bank, which is called Privatbank. And as it so happens, Privatbank is owned by a character called Igor Kolomoisky, or Ihor, if you go by the Ukrainian spelling. And Mr. Kolomoisky is quite well-liked in Washington, or was quite well-liked, because he, when the Eastern Ukrainians sort of decided they didn't care much for this sort of right-wing government or this very nationalist government that had appeared in Kiev, and they started to sort of agitate for separatism and separation and being backed by the Putin's Russia and were advancing westward, Mr. Kolomoisky, who controlled the big, powerful economic region of Dnepropetrovsk, told all his workers to stop work and enlist in his private army, which he'd set up. And so the Kolomoisky private army kind of stopped the westward advance of the separatists. So got it so far. Kolomoisky, popular in Washington, owns the biggest bank in the country. Biggest bank is in big trouble, is going under. Huge international loan money, $4 billion wired to the Ukrainian National Bank, and half of that goes to Mr. Kolomoisky's bank. Mm-hmm. And indeed, it was sorely needed. You know, the economy is going fat and all these people going without wages and so on and so forth. So what happened then? Well, the money, $1.8 billion of that, didn't go to really to prop up the Ukrainian economy. It went by a fairly magical process, or not very magical process, fairly straightforward process. It went offshore, first to Cyprus, and then off to the British Virgin Islands, and to Antigua, and to Belize, and all those sort of big financial hotspots, and disappeared. So we have a situation where our guy in Ukraine, or one of our guys in Ukraine, basically presides over an operation that swipes $1.8 billion. And that's, I think, the piece we're discussing today.
Yeah. So, well, we can get back to how we got into this mess and all that in a minute. But I like the way you described the scam. And, you know, it's very interesting to those of us who have never had those kinds of large amounts of money to move around in business or personally or any other way, to just see how these kinds of things are done. So the U.S. government basically prints the money or conjures it up in a computer with their magic police power, and then they give it to the IMF, and then the IMF gives it to this guy's bank. And then how is it that he doesn't just put it straight in his pocket? He's got to bounce it off the roofs of a couple of places first, and then it goes back in his pocket. How's it
go? Okay. Well, here's a primer for anyone who wants to steal $1.8 billion from the IMF, owns a bank. And so basically what he did was the bank made big loans to a series of Ukrainian companies, which, as it so happened, seemed to be controlled indirectly by Mr. Kolomoisky, who owned the bank. And this money, these companies in turn, made big orders to overseas firms to import goods like, I don't know, cranes, and there was a ice processing, a refrigeration plant, all sorts of stuff like that. And oddly enough, these companies seemed also to be controlled indirectly by entities which were in turn controlled by Mr. Kolomoisky. The Ukrainian firms that had ordered these goods to the total value of $1.8 billion made advance payments for pending the arrival of these goods of 100%. So if they'd ordered a $100 million, refrigeration plant, they sent $100 million into the bank accounts of the companies they were buying the stuff from, which, as it so happened, these accounts were in the Cyprus branch of Privatbank, Mr. Kolomoisky's bank. So if you follow me so far, the bank that's owned by Kolomoisky gets the money from the IMF, from the central bank, which has got it from the IMF. They lend the money to the, to companies which are owned by Kolomoisky. The companies then send advance payments, orders goods, and send advance payments to other companies that are owned by Kolomoisky. And the money goes into the bank, the branch of the bank that's also owned by Kolomoisky. And then the money goes off into other entities, you know, as we said, in the far reaches of the financial galaxy, and mostly in the Caribbean, and hasn't been seen since. So, okay, now how do you make this legal? This is the important thing. Anyone who wants to try and do this should know this is an important twist. As time went by and no goods, of course, were arriving, the companies that had ordered the machinery and other stuff from abroad, they sued in the local court in the city that's controlled by Mr. Kolomoisky, where he was the governor, and said, we've ordered all these goods and they haven't arrived. We want our money back. And by the way, we also want to be let out of the loan, relieved from the obligation to pay back the loan we got from Privatbank. So, and in 42 out of 42 cases where these suits were brought, the court said, A, no, you're still on the hook for the loan. And B, no, you can't get the money. You're not getting the money back from abroad. So in other words, legally, the loan is still on the books. So private banks can say, well, you know, we're still owed these goods, we're still owed this money, and it's all guaranteed by these goods that have been ordered from abroad, which have yet to turn up. Mm-hmm. In other words, there were legal fig leaf over the whole thing. This was first uncovered by a group of very plucky people, investigators in Ukraine.
Yeah, you said they just read it right in the court records. There was nothing secret about it. Whole scams right there. I'm sorry, I got to interrupt you and stop you here and go out to this break, but we'll be right back, everybody, with Andrew Coburn, author of Kill Chain, and this book, this blog at Harper's, Undelivered Goods, about the theft of your tax money by Ukrainian oligarchs. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime Future Freedom author Scott McPherson. Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you all. Welcome back here. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. All right, Andrew Coburn, he wrote the book Rumsfeld, His Rise, Fall, and Catastrophic Legacy. You should read that thing, man. I'm telling you what, it'll blow your mind. There's so much stuff in there. Anyway, and that's just the stuff I can remember. There's even more stuff than that. And then his new book is Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins. And but here he is writing about the corruption in post-coup d'etat Ukraine. And this guy, Kolomoisky, there you go. Let him say it. So he got in good with the Americans because after the coup, when the rebels in the East were really winning, he raised up a private army with his billions that put a halt to their advance. And so that was what won him the I guess, friendship and loyalty of Victoria Nuland and the crew, huh?
Correct. Victoria Nuland, for those, you know, I should remind people, she's the Assistant Secretary of State for Eastern Europe, and she's really been running our Ukraine policy. And it's amazing. I mean, she's had an amazing career. She was an important person in the Clinton State Department, chief of staff to Strobe Talbot, who was Deputy Secretary of State. Then she was Dick Cheney's foreign policy advisor. Then she was ambassador to NATO. Then she was Hillary Clinton's spokesperson. Now she's got this, you know, job running Eastern Europe. And she, you know, now, and she is married to Robert Kagan, who's like the sort of most fanatical of the neocon ideologues. In other words, this is a dyed-in-the-wool neocon who has been stoking up the tensions in Ukraine for, you know, many years now. And, you know, it's very dangerous. You know, Ukraine goes in and out of the news. And yet, you know, here we are confronting, you know, what is still a major power. I guess as you can call Russia a superpower still. It's got lots of nuclear weapons. And no one seems to be paying much attention. And I tell this story of how basically one of our guys ripped off almost $2 billion and has now been given shelter in this country, by the way. He's living happily, I think, in Milwaukee at the moment. So it's a pretty shocking state of affairs.
Yeah, the whole thing is ridiculous. And by the way, if anybody wants to read about Victoria Nuland, there's a great old article from, I don't know, 10 years ago or something by Jim Loeb called All in the Neocon Family. And it begins with a little bit of a profile of her, but it's really about how all of the worst neocons, you could basically fit at one Thanksgiving dinner. It's all the axis of Midge Dechter or whatever, you know, like the Podhoretzes and the Crystals and their relatives, you know, down to Elliot Abrams and whatever. It's very, very tightly knit group there. And in fact, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, it's amazing. Yeah, as you say, there's so few of them and how, you know, they retain their grip on power. You know, Newland's a good example, but maybe they've had their nose a little bit put out of joint with this Iran business. But I mean, basically administrations come and go, but they're still there. It's just incredible.
Well, and yeah, I mean, they completely set the agenda for the entire argument about virtually every policy on TV and in the discussions. And it's just 'cause they don't quit. Bill Kristol, he never stops smiling. He always seems like a nice guy, kind of, if you don't listen to what he's actually saying. And people just, I think in DC, I mean, I don't live there. Maybe you could help me, but it seems like people figure, well, at least we know he'll have a very informed comment to say about whatever it is. So they just bring him on, and he just gets to set the agenda to such a degree. It's crazy.
It's outrageous. I just want to go back to this business about the money being stolen. I mean, it's fairly complicated, but there's this legal mechanism, and they swipe them, almost $2 billion. No one's making the slightest effort to, either indict anyone or to get the money back. And I want to contrast that with the IMF. I mean, the IMF certainly isn't. Meanwhile, the IMF is part of the gang that's screwing the poor old Greeks to the wall, and forcing them to sort of, this mad sort of austerity program that they've got to endure for years and decades to come, because the Greeks were, committed the crime of electing a sort of left-wing populist government. Meanwhile, we've got this bunch of criminals in Ukraine who get, pretty much our wholehearted support. It's completely, I think it's important to look at this story to see how the world really works.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and tell me this, do you know whether the Kiev government, the coup d'etat junta there, do they even mean to implement the Minsk II agreement? Because it seems like they've been, still fighting in the east this whole time. And they're supposed to recognize this newly granted amount of autonomy for the east so that they wouldn't have anything to fight about anymore. And yet the fighting continues.
Well, it's been noticed in the past that every time they run out of money because it's all been stolen, they announce that the Easterners have broken the ceasefire. And so everyone in the West sort of throws up their hands and rushes money and aid to Kiev. And, certainly there's plenty of people who'll tell you that they're the ones who break the ceasefire. So I don't know. It could be maybe sanity is breaking out in defiance of Newland, and maybe Minsk II will be observed, and the Easterners will get their semi-autonomy. And but I don't think so. I think there's such a head of steam up behind the sort of get Russia clique that they're not going to stop now. I mean, we have now. I could be wrong on the numbers. Something getting close to 1,000 NATO troops now in Ukraine training, the Ukrainian forces. The pressure, as I mentioned in my article in Harper's, on the Harper's website, all the time the rhetoric in Washington about we must send military aid to Ukraine. Tom Daschle, important Democratic lobbyist, former majority leader, says we should send $3 billion in aid, partly military aid to Ukraine. So it's being jacked up all the time. I think it's really sinister. I think I'd like to think that everyone's going to observe the Minsk agreement and we can all be happy, but I'm not hopeful.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it was just week before last they announced that they're not just training up the National Guard, which is a nice euphemism for a bunch of Nazis, but now they're going to go ahead and train up the entire army. And apparently they have thousands of Canadians and Australians and British and I guess, that whole Anglophone alliance there. And, I don't know if this is really relevant or not, but I was reading a couple of stories about Hillary Clinton's emails and about, there's this one in Politico about how there's this one lady who ever talks to her like a peer and tells her no, disagrees with her about anything, where everyone else is the lowest, most pathetic form of sycophant you could imagine, right? To make Smithers look like Burns. And so, I mean, what comes out of that is that no one ever tells her she's wrong about nothing, so therefore she doesn't know nothing. She starts out wrong about everything. No one ever informs her opinion whatsoever, so she's basically, deaf, blind, and stupid up there, as bad as George W. Bush, it seems like. And I just wonder whether you think, that's really what's going on. Kind of, you said the head of steam behind this hate Russia thing. It's that stupid, isn't it? Well, geez, John McCain and Hillary Clinton agree that Vladimir Putin is a really bad guy, so let's just jump on this bandwagon. And there's no one really saying, come on, guys, we all know we're lying, right? We did the coup and they're just reacting. As long as we know we're lying, it's okay. But let's make sure we don't really believe our own stupid slogans here. But I'm not so sure that it's really like that,
Yeah, exactly so. Exactly so. I mean, the most terrifying word in the in the Washington context is consensus. And once you've got a consensus on something, we're in for trouble. And now they're all agreeing. They absolutely agree that, as you say, Putin bad. you know, gallant little Ukraine, you know, has to be saved. And, you know, I think that I've heard people, you know, important people in Washington say it's time we have to send, a lethal defensive weapons to Ukraine to kill more Russians. I mean, I swear to God, I've actually heard sort of high level State Department people say that.
Yeah. And in fact, that's kind of the talking point, like weapons of mass destruction, kill Russians. That's what they're saying. In fact, when they had the Brookings report that came out, and they had, oh man, I'm sorry, I'm forgetting the name of the ambassador who had, it was Michelle Flournoy and a few others, had done this report, I'd guess about a year ago now, saying that we needed to send all these weapons. And I remember the guy was interviewed on, National Public Radio, the head ambassador. Man, if chat room guys, if you know the name of the guy I'm thinking of,
Herbst.
Help me out here.
Herbst. But, what do you call it, Herbst or something, the former ambassador to Ukraine?
No. Yeah. Anyway, but and his argument was that if we kill Russians, if the war in Ukraine gets worse, and we're killing more Russians and sending more Russians home in body bags, then that will upset the mothers of the dead soldiers, and that will cause the debate to go up in Russia.
Yes.
That was how he said it. The debate to go up. That we're going to make the debate go up. Well. So by killing Russians and sending Russians home in body bags, their so-called calculus is that it will become politically impossible for Putin and everybody to his right to wage a war to avenge those deaths. Oh, hell no. That's not even, you know, possible in this universe. It will, after the debate goes up, they'll decide to just let America screw them in Ukraine as bad as we want, and they'll no longer do anything about it. What a brilliant policy.
Yeah. By the way, I think it is. I think we are talking about John Herbst. He's a complete maniac.
It could
be. He was ambassador to Ukraine.
I was thinking it was a longer, like three syllable name with an A at the beginning somewhere, but I'd have to look at it.
Could be.
But anyway, I mean, all these. I mean, but that's kind of the level of argument here. We're gonna send dead Russians home when they're kind of pretending that there's been this, you know, giant invasion by the Russian infantry anyway. But assuming that there are some special forces there, which I guess is a safe assumption that. I mean, is that really what passes for an argument? Is that by killing them, that's going to make them want to bow down to us rather than make them angry enough to want to fight even more? I mean, this is a country that lost 20 million people killing the Germans in World War II. They're just going to bow down and take this from the U.S. right now?
Exactly so. I mean, you know, it's completely insane. And it's, you know, it's like, you know, it's like all the other arguments, you know, that, like sanctions. I mean, it's a whole other story why we've had these negotiations with the Iranians. But in my belief, it's not because of sanctions. You know, there's always this belief if you inflict pain on people, they'll do what you tell them. But actually, history shows that's not what happens.
Yeah.
And it's certainly true what you're saying here. I mean, it's obscene anyway. And what they're really talking about is killing more Ukrainians, by the way.
Of course, on both sides.
We're going to kill another 50,000 Ukrainians, you know, the people we supposedly love in pursuit of this, you know, lunatic policy. And in the meantime, you know, we smile as, you know, as these criminals. I mean, this is just one little story. There's so much more you could say about, you know, the looting of Ukraine. But I just told this story on the Harper's blog just to show this is what's really going on. You know, we smile as these people get completely ripped off. And meanwhile, we're planning to kill another tens of thousands of them and all in the name of love.
Yep. Well, it's good journalism. I'm sure glad you're doing it. Thank you very much, Andrew.
Hey, thank you, Scott. Always a pleasure.
All right, y'all, that is Andrew Coburn. He's the author of Rumsfeld, His Rise, Fall, and Catastrophic Legacy. Got that right. Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins, which is great. You really got to read that. And check him out over at Harper's. Heart of Empire is his blog there. Undelivered Goods, How $1.8 billion in aid to Ukraine was funneled to the outposts of the international finance galaxy.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods's Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code SCOTT when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Next up on the show today is Brad Smith, friend of the show, and veteran of the 1989 War on Panama. I won't say war with, because that would imply that they were kind of fighting in it, too, against us, and not so much, I guess. Check out his what he wrote up about it for us here, the truth about the 1989 invasion of Panama, at my website, scotthorton.org, at the blog there, stress, scotthorton.org/stress, the truth about the 1989 invasion of Panama by Brad Smith. Welcome to the show, Brad. How are you?
Oh, real good. How are you doing, Scott?
I'm doing real good. I appreciate you joining us. I appreciate you writing this up for us.
Oh, thanks. I like your show and everything you're doing.
Cool, man. Well, I was telling the audience at the beginning of the show, I know I've read some articles here and there, but I don't think I've ever read a good book on the Panama War. Only The Commanders by Bob Woodward, which doesn't count as a good book about it. So I know a little bit about it, you know, from that and just from articles I've read, and The Panama Deception, the great documentary from back then.
That's a good one. You can, if you're ever interested in it, you can check out, Our Man in Panama.
Yeah.
That's a pretty good book.
Okay.
Yeah, he makes some good points.
All right. That's going on the list. All right, so tell us name, rank, serial number, this, that. When'd you join up, and what were you doing, and all those things?
Let's see. I joined in February of '88. I spent about 2 years in. I started working for S2, which is battalion-level military intelligence. And then just before the invasion, I was bumped back into the headquarters for the 1st Platoon, Bravo Company 521 out of 7th Infantry Division Light. We were the light fighters. We were carrying just an infantry unit, about on line with the 10th Mountain Division, I guess. Mm-hmm. We went in with 82nd, the Ranger Battalions, those guys. Yeah, it was, I'll just jump right into Panama. It was, let's just say we just bombed the living hell out of the place. There was about, they say 24 sites, and I would say that's probably about right if you talk about just the major sites, the different barracks all over the country that were just hammered from the air. You know, they came in with the C-130 Spectre gunships, you know, which you probably couldn't use in anything like Iraq, but in Panama, where they basically couldn't fight back, they could just circle over top of them and just riddle them with bullets and shells. And they said they had 442 bombs large enough dropped to hit the seismograph, too. So, you know, it was just, you know, hell from above.
Yeah, you know, you talk about in the article, too, about how, well, we can get back to all the attacks on the military barracks and all that in a minute, but you talk about how there was this one poor part of town that was just decimated, and I think quite a bit of that is shown in that documentary, The Panama Deception, where, do you know what was going on there? They're just testing out daisy cutters, or they just missed, or?
No, what happened there was that's where Noriega had his headquarters at, La Comandancia, and that ended up being a running battle that took about, I'm going to say about 12 hours to actually take that place. The Panamanians call it the Night of Fire. And all around that neighborhood, they were just running battles. I mean, we had tanks in the streets and, Now, they had, I mean, you're talking about Hellfire missiles being fired pretty much indiscriminately in a civilian part of town. I mean, there were tanks that ran over cars. There were, you know, they were, you know, just, you can't imagine unless you've been there seeing what happens when you unleash that kind of firepower in a very small, poor, you know, urban area. And we, of course, covered it up pretty well because as soon as it was over, we pretty much went in and just bulldozed everything. The press, of course, that, from what I understand, covered Panama pretty openly, except for they said nothing about El Chorrillo. The Panamanians call it Little Hiroshima. And it's what it looked like.
Wow.
When they were done, it looked like somebody had dropped an A-bomb. Because it just, it was, you know, the construction there, it's wood construction, it's poor, it burnt, and it just, the fires just raged through, and tons of people got trapped there. I personally can't say exactly how many people died. I know it's a contentious thing, but I don't think it really matters. We didn't have a right to do it. We had no business being there killing that many people. The military said, well, you know, we didn't just have mass graves, except for that we had to do it for, you know, health reasons. Well, okay. You know, so they're saying it wasn't a cover-up. They just had to bury all these bodies because it was for sanitary reasons.
Well, now, when it comes to the civilian casualties in that neighborhood, can you give us at least the size of the ballpark that the debate is between here?
I can't.
Thousands, tens of thousands? Or
no, I would say that from everything that I've read and studied and from what I saw personally, I think the estimates of about 4,000 are probably right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and as far as the Panama military, you know what, I'd have to say about 500. But you have to realize that's only 3,000 people that they had to begin with. And, you know, so 500 out of 3,000, that's a pretty high casualty rate. And that's not including the Dignitary Battalion, which a lot of those guys got hunted down and killed later in Operation Promote Liberty. You know, that was just, the Dignitary Battalion was just him handing out weapons to anybody he thought was loyal.
Yeah.
I'm talking all the way down to 8-year-old kids. You know, they, those guys were, I think some of them just hated us. Some of them just didn't want us there. You know, some of them were terrible people too. I mean, he wasn't very picky about who he handed weapons out to. I think one of the strangest things was how the people supported us in some areas and, of course, hated us in others. The closer they came to where we used heavy firepower,
yeah,
you know, they hated us. But they hated our government, you know, and I call it our government in Panama because it, of course, was at the time,
right.
Which is missed by a lot of people that, you know, Noriega was definitely our man.
Well, yeah, let's talk about that. Well, no, let's put that off until after the break, because there's a lot to talk about with Noriega there and the whole regime change and everything. But as far as the battle itself, you know, it sounds like you're pretty impressed with the unfairness of the fight, where these gunships are just destroying these barracks. Maybe 500 doesn't sound like that many to people in the context of a war or something like that. But you're talking about in one night's time or one or 2 days' time. And then you also talk about they wanted to just, you know, they were like turf battles where instead of sending in, you know, low and slow and close and slaughter them from a C-130, then, the Air Force guys want to fly their F-117s and see if they can hit the barracks with that.
Oh, that was Rio Hato, and that was just really made no sense at all. They could have done the same thing, just hit them with C-130s, and instead you ended up with a massive mess up, and it was, they wanted to use their toys. The same thing happened to the SEALs. The SEALs that went into the Punta Batia Airport, that was not a SEAL mission. That was just stupid. I was at Punta Batia about 3 days after the SEALs hit it. And I looked at the terrain, and the first thing I thought was, wow, this was not a mission for the SEALs. They took three platoons of them, tried to sneak them in, and they got caught running across the tarmac and just slaughtered. The one platoon, I think, was 12 guys that ran out onto the runway, and four of them were killed, seven of them seriously wounded. So 11 out of the 12 were laying there on the airport.
Yeah, the economics of bureaucracy to blame, of course.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. All right, hold it right there. Hold it right there. We got to stop and take this break. It's Brad Smith, veteran of Operation Just Cause against Panama in 1989. We'll be right back. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, talking with Brad Smith. He was in the war against Panama in December 1989, and he wrote this piece that I published at scotthorton.org/stress, the truth about the 1989 invasion of Panama. And at the break there, we were talking about, you know, stupid missions that were made for, you know, Joseph Heller type reasons, like let's send the Navy SEALs to take this airport in a way that just led them into a slaughter and this kind of stupidity. Missing targets with their F-117 stealth bombers that clearly had no business, you know, engaging in this kind of war. But, you know, that kind of like a bad episode of MASH basically going on as these decisions are made for just how to kill these people and who to kill.
Yeah, all of the other barracks around the country, you know, dozens and dozens, they just hammered them with the C-130s. When they went into Rio Hato, they just missed. They dropped two 5,000-pound bombs on an empty field.
Oh, well, actually, that's not so bad. They probably should have done more of the war like that then, I guess.
Well, they just shouldn't have done it at all. What's really bad is at the time, I have to say I was grateful, in a way, that we'd use such overwhelming force. I was married. I had a, 6-month-old daughter. But as I grew older, it weighs on you more and more because you realize just how wrong it was. And we just slaughtered people. It's not a war. I don't even know if it's I think they called it a contingency plan.
Yeah. Hey, did they even give him a chance to surrender, or it was just sneak attack in the middle of the night, Pearl Harbor style, that's it?
Yeah, Pearl Harbor style. Yeah, there was no warning. Everybody was, in fact, when we got alerted, we hadn't even been told. We just walked in, boom, pack your stuff, we are going. That you didn't contact your family, that was operational security. In fact, we were actually put behind barbed wire before we were told where we were going, because they did not want news sneaking out to anybody. So they just hammered 24 different groups of barracks around the country in one police station. The rest of the police stations we took down one at a time, just going there, taking them over, blocking patrol, getting snitches, kicking in doors. Yeah, and then, of course, later we disarmed the people themselves.
Right. Okay. Well, yeah. Talk about that, and then we'll get to Noriega and the reason for the regime change. But talk about your occupation of the place when they changed it from Operation Just Because to Operation Promote Liberty.
Right. There was an intermediate step. First, we hammered all the barracks, then we pushed out into the countryside. We would just go up to a police station, boom, take it over. By then, the police knew we were coming. A couple times, they waited for us and just surrendered. But the rest of the time, we had to go door to door, kicking in doors, grabbing them. We'd get snitches. You'd walk around and go, hey, where are these guys? And for the most part, they were pretty happy to tell us. They were pretty brutal. So when we'd go, but then we started kicking in doors just to get guns. Well, by then, we weren't as popular anymore.
That was what they called Operation Promote Liberty. You got to love them Bushes, man.
And here's another thing that I think people aren't aware of, but if there had been a big outcry over that war, none of the rest of the wars of this century might have happened.
Yeah, that was like their trial run for Desert Storm there. Hey, we got away with it in Panama. Hell yeah.
Oh, absolutely. That was Bush. That was unilateral. Completely. Nobody else was supposed to do it. Cheney was on TV a couple months before say, oh, we'll never do that because the hue and cry would be massive. Because he knew it was an illegal invasion. It wasn't. The UN said it was illegal. But they got away with it. That was on Powell, actually. Powell was a big one pushing for the Panama War.
Yeah. Well, what's funny, too, is if you think about it now, I mean, what possible situation could have existed where the USA had no choice but to invade Panama? I mean, give me a break.
They claimed that he had started it because he killed a couple service members. What they don't tell you is that we are purposely driving these guys armed by right next to their headquarters where they weren't allowed. They were called the hard chargers, these guys. They went in and purposely got themselves shot up so that they'd have some kind of excuse, I guess.
Yeah, these things happen.
Yeah.
All right. Now, so what was the reason for the regime change anyway? Because everybody knows that America created Panama. We stole it from Colombia to build a canal across it. It's U.S.-owned property, certainly at this time, before they gave up the canal at the, 99 or whatever it was.
Well, your guest from the other day, Seymour Hersh, probably had some to start with it, which is a funny way to put it.
Really?
But, he was one of the first people to start writing about Noriega playing both sides of the fence. He was sharing information with Cuba and at the same time dealing drugs and all of that. And then it started spreading that we were going to take him down over drugs. So that got him all up in arms. That got Noriega ticked off. And what he did was he captured a cargo ship going through the canal full of small arms that was headed to the Contras. He offloaded them and handed them out to the Dignitary Battalion, handed them out to people.
Mm-hmm.
We collected thousands and thousands of these weapons and shipped them, boxed them up. We were supposed to be shipping them back to the U.S., but I never saw anyone when we got back. So
that was it right there. That was where D.C. and Langley's head exploded, and they said, this guy's going to die.
Right. Right, exactly.
Well, and they buried him under the prison, I guess, in Florida. Well, they hadn't killed him yet.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that was absolutely the final straw. I mean, some of it was the press getting out because that made him belligerent. And, I think at that point he probably thought we were seriously about taking him down. I don't know if we were at that point. But by the time he did the weapons thing, they sure as hell were.
Did they even have...
That was the thing that couldn't get out.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't going to let the public know that, because Congress at that point had already told Langley to stop it. Congress had already made a declaration to stop arming the Contras at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So when he went and grabbed all these weapons, that was a pretty big deal. If he'd gone public with it. Actually, what's funny is that at the time, I came back and I read reports about the weapons. And the only thing I ever found, come across on it, was that they claimed those weapons came from Cuba.
Right.
That Castro was helping Noriega arm his troops.
Yeah.
Well, Noriega didn't need any help from Castro. We had no problem arming him before that.
Right. Yeah, he had plenty of weapons from us. Now, so I wonder, did anybody ever challenge them and ask them, or was that ever a point of the revisionist history of whether they could have just found some friendly colonels and done a coup against Noriega rather than invading the place the way they did? They had a chance to invade a place, and they took it, is what really happened.
It's actually worse than that. We encouraged a coup 2 months before the invasion. Well, actually, we encouraged a coup quite a while before that. But when the coup actually took place, we were supposed to support it by blocking off reinforcements. One of their colonels actually had Noriega at gunpoint in his office at La Comandancia. So they had him, and we did not back the coup. All we were supposed to do was stop his reinforcements. We backed out on it. Noriega got the guy disarmed and actually shot that colonel with the gun that he had been holding on Noriega.
And did they deliberately withhold that because they wanted the chance for war, is what you're saying?
Oh, yeah. Or it was just
they hadn't really made that final decision to invade yet at that point?
No, I think at that point they'd already gone too far with all the planning.
So, no, let's sabotage the coup so that we have the excuse for the war.
Exactly.
USA, exactly. USA, that's how they pronounce it there. It's exceptional. Yeah. All right, hey, listen, man, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show and telling us your story, Brad. I really appreciate it a lot.
Hey, you're welcome, and keep up the good work.
All right, y'all, that is Brad Smith, former U.S. Army, 7th Infantry. And you can read his article at scotthorton.org/stress, the truth about the 1989 invasion of Panama. We'll be right back. Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at mastersamuraitech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from mastersamuraitech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at mastersamuraitech.com. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. If this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. Cool, man. We got Coolidge back in rotation here. I like those guys, man. All right, the Descendants. If you don't know, you could Google it. All right, man. So, it's the Scott Horton Show. I'm him. ScottHorton.org is the website. I got 3,900 and something interviews for you there if you want to listen to a lot of interviews or just some. ScottHorton.org. Join up the chat room during the live show, man. If you're listening to the live show, we're here noon to 2 Eastern time on the Liberty Radio Network. 11 to 1 Texas time, that is. On the Liberty Radio Network. And, I keep the chat room open. Got a good little crew in there today. At scotthorton.org/chat. Fake name and a captcha, and you're in there, man. So, cool. See you there. Hey, guess what? Tomorrow, I'm starting a new show on liberty.me. It's going to be with Jacob Hornberger, and it's going to be every Thursday night, and it's going to be called The Future of Freedom. And it's going to be me interviewing Hornberger about all the things he wrote so far that week, each week. And he writes, I think, every single day, at least 4 times a week, if not 5. So it's not going to be a co-hosty type situation like with me and Tucker on Eye on the Empire. It's going to be... Well, you know me. I talk a lot in my interviews anyway, don't I? But still, I'm going to try not to as much. The form of it is going to be me interviewing him. The Future of Freedom on live streaming YouTube, Google Hangout thing, Jam there on liberty.me. Tomorrow will be the first episode, 8 o'clock Eastern time at liberty.me. And the show will be called, guess what? The Future of Freedom. Yeah. And then also, get this, the Tucker Show, Eye on the Empire at liberty.me. That one is now going to be every other Tuesday on a regular schedule. Because, see, our problem was we were doing it all haphazard all over the place. Sometimes Thursday, Friday, Sunday, nobody knows. Like a TV show they're trying to get canceled, you know, they move it all around. We've been doing that to ourselves. But now it's going to be every other Tuesday. And what's good about that is that means that you can just go to liberty.me every Tuesday night. That's just your place to hang out because every other Tuesday will be Lucy Steigerwald and Sheldon Richman. And so we'll be alternating Tuesdays at 8 Eastern with them. So that's pretty cool, don't you think? All right. Okay, more news. Again, top news is today's the day. Senator Barbara Mikulski from Maryland has announced that she is supporting the Iran deal. And that means that the Republicans and the Israel First Democrats will not be able to override the president's veto. Once it's assumed that they will be able to override any attempt at a filibuster and will get the deal passed, but then the anti-deal resolution passed, but then Obama will veto it, and they now lack the number of senators that they would need to override the veto. So, now I guess it's possible that if it really came to that in a few weeks, that some of these senators could switch their votes and, you know, backstab the president and go ahead and help override the veto anyway. That is still within the realm of possibility, but doesn't seem very likely. Once they've announced they're voting for it, they're voting for it. So that's it. Yay. They got the deal and they've got the Congress locked. So sanctions will be lifted and Iran will continue to be within their safeguards agreement. Only now they'll have an additional protocol to their safeguards agreement again. And now they'll have all kinds of expanded inspections and they'll be reducing their number of spinning centrifuges and they'll be taking one of their enrichment plants completely offline. Will be turning into just a research facility with no nuclear materials present whatsoever. Both of their reactors will be configured to never be able to produce weapons-grade plutonium as waste. And that's it, man. And the sanctions will be lifted. And America's economic war is what the sanctions means. Economic war will be ended. No, partially ended. All the sanctions in the name of the nuclear program. There are still other sanctions because of the coup of 79, or not the coup, the revolution of 79, because of the, you know, support for Hamas and Hezbollah and whatever else, you know. They still have some sanctions, but nothing like the crippling sanctions that Obama put on them in order to get this deal done, which seems to have worked. And anyway, so there you go. Done deal. It's kind of a slow motion done deal, so I don't feel quite as celebratory now, but today's the day they finally got it locked up. Thanks to this Senator Mikulski. What would really be great would be if the pro-deal forces in the country would keep calling the other swing voter senators and see if is it even within the realm of possibility that we could get somebody to filibuster the thing and prevent the Republicans from even being able to pass their negative resolution. Remember, in the Senate, the threshold can be made to be 61 votes, not 51. So, anyway, I don't know. That'd be great to see. But anyway, that's what you need to know. That's the good news of the day. That's the top story of the day. And there's a lot of top stories of the day, but that's the top of the top ones. Okay, next on my list is the heroic Gareth Porter, who bombed Khobar Towers, anatomy of a crooked terrorism investigation. Well, all the hype is that, oh, Iran did it. Iranian-backed Saudi Hezbollah bombed the Khobar Towers. And what they really mean by that is Louis Free, the head of the FBI, bent right over for the Saudis and the Israelis and decided that he would let the guilty parties who had murdered 19 American airmen and wounded a great many more. I forgot. I don't have it right in front of me. Maybe I do. Wounded 372. Would get away with it because they decided for political reasons they would rather pin it on Iran. And it was a bunch of crap. It was Osama bin Laden and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed that did the Khobar Towers attack. And why? Because they wanted American combat forces off the Arabian Peninsula. That's why. too bad Bill Clinton never told the truth to you about a single damn thing in his whole life. Oh, yeah. They hate us because we're free. It has nothing to do with any, you know, military forces stationed on their holy peninsula. Military forces that are used to daily bomb and enforce a blockade on Iraq that's killed 1 million people. Nah, nobody minds that. They just hate you because you got a color TV and they're jealous. Anyway, Gareth Porter's a good reporter, and he's got Michael Scheuer, and he's got 4 or 5 different FBI agents on the record in this story, going back and showing Scheuer, that's the former chief of the CIA's Bin Laden unit. It was Osama that did it, and Osama took credit for it, too. And anyway, if you missed this, this is huge, but it has kind of a happy ending, only sort of, kind of, silver lining on a dark cloud. West Point professor calls on U.S. military to target legal critics of the terror war. And his name was William Bradford, and you can read about this at The Guardian. West Point professor calls on U.S. military to target legal critics of the war on terrorism. The same guy once wrote a thing wondering aloud about whether maybe the military should remove Barack Obama from power. If he's just, you know, too un-American, which is nice and vague enough to not mean anything at all. Never even heard of the power of the cabinet to declare him incompetent or the power of the Congress to impeach and indict him and remove him from power. But anyway, maybe the military should just go and kick the old man out of the chair. Why not? Who's going to stop him? The Capitol Police? Well, anyway, and he's also said that professors who make legal arguments that accused terrorists have rights amount to a treasonous fifth column in America, and they should be rounded up, he argued. He's been forced to resign now. That's the silver lining. But it's the fact that he even wrote this stuff and got it published, West Point professor, is, I think, a very important weather vane, let you know where the homeland stands at this point, halfway through 2015 here. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. All right, so it is election season, but I hate electoral politics and stuff. But it is kind of important, although it's also very stupid and irrelevant at the same damn time, but in different ways. But so I think the way I usually handle this is I mostly ignore all the horse race stuff as much as I can. But when the candidates say things wrong of substance, then I'll use that as an opportunity to explain what the truth is as compared to the political narrative at the time. So you might get some of that. But yeah, not right now. You're not. All right. Now, here's all I got to say about this because I don't have time. I got to talk about serious stuff. So. But you gotta know about this. If you don't know about this, then that's why I got to tell you about this. If you go and look at electronicintifada.net, you can find it. You can find it all over the place. It's the Tamimi family in Palestine. And this soldier, this IDF soldier occupying the West Bank is attempting to violently kidnap this boy who I think is probably 10. Got his hand around his neck in a full, like, sleeper hold. Maybe chokehold type headlock. The kid is completely, you know, terrified out of his mind. And then all the women and girls come and fight off the IDF. Hero! And they bite him and kick him and slap him and hit him until his commanding officer finally comes up and tells him to let the kid go and go. And then, of course, he throws a smoke, you know, tear gas grenade at them on his way out of there because he's a little bitch who got his ass kicked by a bunch of girls because he was trying to kidnap a little boy. And I think if you watch that video and I think if you share that video, then, you know, that would do a little bit to help spread just basic understanding of the situation in the occupied territories. Americans, everybody else in the world has it spoken plain to them, I guess. But Americans just don't get it of what's going on over there. These people conquered under a foreign government's martial law, military dictatorship, with no representation whatsoever for 50 years. Their land stolen, their children tortured. On your dime. Your dime. Go and watch this video. It's crazy, dude. You know, Haaretz, which is, you know, the liberal daily, the New York Times of Israel, basically, has an official editorial, not just an op-ed, but an official editorial of the paper. They call it a perfect picture of the occupation. The worthless, useless, horrible occupation that, in their understanding, will have to end someday anyway. You're going to have to give up the West Bank to these people. It's theirs. And so what is the point of this? And it's just cruelty, man. So go and look at it. A perfect picture of the occupation. That's the official Haaretz editorial. And go watch the video at Electronic Intifada. The heroic Tamimi women and girls saving their little boy from God knows what fate. All right, now, Petraeus, this isn't new to you, but still, The Daily Beast. By Nancy Youssef, our friend Nancy Youssef, and by Shane Harris. Petraeus, use Al-Qaeda fighters to beat ISIS. And this story came from dissenters. Now, Shane Harris seems kind of a hawkish consensus, sort of, I think, a right-wing kind of a guy, as best I can tell. Now, Nancy Youssef, she's not. She's just a great reporter. And if anything, I think she's got an anti-war bent. I don't know. But this article clearly came from people who are pissed off about this. This is not Petraeus spinning this, going, yeah, man, the Al-Qaeda are the moderates now, which they do have comment from people on his side. But there are people inside the government. Remember we interviewed Mark Perry about the war in Yemen, where people inside the Pentagon are saying, man, we don't want to fight for Al-Qaeda. We don't want to fight for them in Syria, and we don't want to fight for them in Yemen. And what are we doing? We're happy to blow up stuff, but directly flying as Al-Qaeda's Air Force? Does that sound right to you? And these are the flag officers talking to Mark Perry. And basically, what Petraeus is spinning here is this ridiculous theory of the mythical moderates from 2012 that they've been practicing and failing at this entire time. Since the Arab Spring began and American Saudi tried to hijack the protest movement in Syria and turn it into this disaster. Oh, and the Turks and the Qataris and the Israelis, I don't mean to leave them out. And all this time, all they've done is create a civil war that's killed hundreds of thousands of people and millions of refugees. A couple of hundred grand are dead. Grand, like it's money. A couple of hundred thousand dead. Millions of refugees, perhaps even more refugees in the Iraq War, which of course must include a lot of the refugees from the Iraq War who are still living in Syria. And that's why they're drowning in the Mediterranean Sea right now. Because this has been Petraeus' policy all along. Granted, Obama never let him do it as bad as he wanted to, but yeah, he did let him do it. He did let Hillary and Petraeus and Panetta do their regime change in Libya. Or what was Panetta at that time? I got to look at a timeline of when they shifted all their offices around, because Gates was the Secretary of Defense at the start of Libya, but I know Petraeus was the head of the CIA replaced. Oh, yeah. And then anyway, doesn't damn matter. When Petraeus was the head of the CIA and Panetta was the head of the DOD, that's what I was trying to say. Panetta replaced Gates at DOD And then Petraeus moved from losing the Afghan war to being the head of the CIA. And then they worked with Hillary to do the jihad transfer from Libya to Syria and get that war done. This is how they got the ambassador killed, is because they're all guilty of the highest treason, fighting on behalf of the veterans of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, and Ansar al-Sharia in Libya, and helping them funnel their guns and their terrorists to Syria to go suicide bomb themselves, a regime change against Bashar al-Assad and his government there. And now Petraeus is coming right out again and really pushing for it. I'm not certain who all is paying him, but saying that what we need to do is replicate the Sons of Iraq and Concerned Local Citizens movement of the days of the Anbar Awakening. Yeah, well, they had 100,000 American soldiers to back them up during that time. And they had a huge tribal movement that was responsible for the insurgency all along, and a secular Ba'athist movement as well, that were not beholden to the jihadists. The jihadists were the smallest part of the Iraqi Sunni insurgency, who were tolerated as long as they were useful, and then were quickly destroyed, stabbed in the back, and at least, you know, greatly reduced back down from the so-called Islamic State of Iraq to just, you know, suicide terrorists with no real army at all. And how in the hell is that supposed to happen in Syria right now, other than putting 100,000 American soldiers on the ground there? And who the hell believes that the jihadists are the smallest part of the revolution, so-called revolution, the Sunni jihadist side of the civil war in Syria? Because, nope, wrong, the mythical moderates are the minority here. And mostly, that's just a bunch of spin. Mostly, that's when they call the Al-Farouk Brigade cannibals, the moderates. Or the Northern Storm Brigade, who sold Stephen Sotloff to ISIS, the moderates. Or Ahrar al-Sham, who work directly for the Saudis and who are absolutely no different and interchange personnel constantly with the al-Nusra Front, which is al-Qaeda in Syria, and the Islamic State as well. And the al-Nusra Front itself is run by guys who were former members, leaders of the Islamic State, who just, you know, broke off. They're all a bunch of jihadists. Patrick Coburn says, hey, reporting from the Turkish-Syrian border here, I'm talking with hardcore jihadists, I'm talking with mythical moderates, and guess what they all say? Suicide bomb and behead a Christian for Jesus, or for Muhammad, or, sorry, yeah, not for Jesus. I'm just used to saying it that way. Nuke a gay baby whale for Jesus, or whatever. You know what I mean. They're all a bunch of, he asked them, what do you guys think of the September 11th attacks on America? And they're all like, yeah, man, that was a great one. These are our mythical moderates that David Petraeus wants us to back there. Oh, and the Russian jets thing, someone was asking about the Russian jets thing. I haven't seen any confirmation. I saw one article in Wynette, and I saw it disputed in pro-Russian papers and stuff. So I'd have to see a better source than Wynette for that, about Russians joining the war against ISIS in Syria. I don't think that's right.